My name is Kevin Cahill, and I live in Exeter in Devon. I'm a journalist and an author, and I worked at the Sunday Times and in Parliament, and I still work as a journalist.
Okay, can you tell us about your work with the land
Land
holdings?
holdings assigned me to look at old money in the UK, which essentially was land. So I did all the land stuff and eventually wrote the first book on land ownership that actually names the landowners. This was the difference between my book and anything else that's been written. I named all the landowners and I named the size of their estates from the Second Domesday, which had been lost. Extraordinary how a country can lose a whole doomsday, but it had. So I then wrote another book called Who Owns the World? And finally, I wrote a book called Who Owns Ireland 2 years ago.
One of the most interesting things about this is the Crown Estate, isn't it? And the King Charles last year and this year has awarded himself enormous pay rises.
Yeah, I mean, it's a complete anomaly. The King Charles III, remains, because nobody's changed anything, the largest landowner, legal landowner on earth. He owns, through the constitutions, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, and all sorts of places in the Caribbean. He is the ultimate landowner, and nothing has been done to change that. Now, in the UK, again, because freeholds are not ownership. Most people don't know that. Freehold in the United Kingdom is a leasehold from the Crown, ultimately. So the person, you think you own your house and you say, I have the freehold, you don't own it. The Crown owns your house.
Yeah, but that's so nominal, surely. I mean, the idea that anyone who owns land in Australia, New Zealand, etc., the King's not going to come and claim that, is he?
No, it's the claims are, they're not unenforceable in Canada in particular, which is very odd. The Crown ownership is ruthlessly enforced by the Canadian government, which is weird. In Australia, it's more shaky. The Australians are not formally querying this setup, but there are a lot of questions being raised in Australia about, how the indigenous land was taken from the indigenous people and how it all wound up in the hands of the British Crown, 12,000 miles away.
Okay, so can you tell us a bit about the Crown Estate? Where does it sit between private and public?
The Crown Estate, again, is a complete anomaly. It acts as a private estate, but pretends it's a public corporation. It doesn't pay the normal taxes. The other thing is it distorts the position of the Crown, because the Crown Estate, in effect, means the largest landowner in the United Kingdom is the King. And that's completely unbalanced. The rules are not applied to him, they're not applied to the estate. And huge amount of income from the public goes to the Crown. And
Yeah, well, King Charles will say it's not actually his land, that this is some sort of arm's length business that he doesn't control.
it's not an arm's length business in the slightest. The papers I fished out in relation to the Crown Estate in London, I mean, they were actually the Crown Estate was deciding the colour of the front doors on part of its estate, and deciding which bits of London to buy and which bits of London to sell. In the early stages of the coalition government in 2010, the Tories transferred the ownership of the Crown Estate quite formally to the Crown. So now there's no confusion. The Crown owns the Crown Estate and directs the Crown Estate. And it's a very hands-on direction. And
Have you
huge.
seen over the last couple of years since the Queen has died, Charles has been awarding himself pay rises each year of around about 30, 40 million pounds.
Yep.
Can you just tell us what's been going on there?
This is money that's obtained, if you like, because he owns the Crown Estate. It's not taxed in the ordinary way. And the transfer of the Crown Estate from the late Queen to Charles was not taxed in any way. It was just a transfer that can't occur for anybody else. You know, if you or I die and leave an estate, we have to pay death duties. No death duties were paid on the richest and largest lump of land in the United Kingdom. But the Tories were complicit with the fiddle, and it was a fiddle. It remains to be seen if Labour are willing to tackle. It's going to be a two-stage thing. The position of the monarch is going to have to be regularised in a more normal way, like he has to declare his assets, etc., etc. And then the way the money from the Crown Estate is paid over to the monarch has to be regulated. You know, if you register your property in a offshore company and you trade, you know, you sell the company to somebody else, you don't pay any tax. It's a tax-free fiddle. And it was a special fiddle, specially arranged by the last government we had. So, you know, it's going to be a monumental task to straighten this business of what the monarch is and what the monarch owns and how it's to be regulated.
Yeah, it's not just that, is it? I mean, people from the Crown Estate obviously are appointed by the monarch. Even government ministers officially are actually appointed by the king.
Yeah.
The new government needs to start. Reform the monarchy, reform the land registry, and give ownership of the freeholds to the public. There's nothing in the, what do you call it, the agenda, the Labour Party programme, to even touch these subjects.
What do you make of the latest developments with the surveillance network? Because I've been looking at some interesting articles this week about the whole idea really seems to be now to have mass warrantless surveillance of every single human being on the planet, certainly within the Western world. And this seems now to be the norm. So we've gone from an era where anybody that wanted to put anyone under surveillance would have to go to a judge and get approval for it, to now where it's just routine, de rigueur, all the time.
The mass surveillance in the UK is criminal and unlawful, and you're hearing it here properly for the first time. At the moment, the Investigatory Powers Tribunal of the High Court of England and Wales has actually accepted and is looking at a case complaining about mass surveillance in the UK. And the last time I made that application, the court actually granted my application. So I'm moderately optimistic. But certainly the court has accepted the application. It hasn't rejected it. And in that application, the people who are responsible for the mass surveillance in the UK, the Information Commissioner and the police, they're responsible in the sense. When Parliament told them this was happening and it was criminal, they did nothing. And that the High Court now has the case. And I can tell you here, and you won't hear it anywhere else, the case before the High Court has been referred to the Privy Council. How about that?
Yeah, but I mean, these are all people who are kind of ex-insiders, establishment government ministers, etc. They're surely not going to act on the public's behalf and not stick their necks out.
Well, as I say, the way this has been handled is novel. The Privy Council has never got involved in anything, even though sovereignty and jurisdiction, which are completely wiped out by the mass surveillance, are its most serious issue. You know, anything that affects the law, jurisdiction and sovereignty should be referred immediately to the Privy Council. This wasn't, but it has been now. So it remains to be seen what Labour do about this.
Well, look, I mean, at the end of the day, the Privy Council is really controlled by the monarchy, as is GCHQ and the intelligence services. So everything, really, all roads lead back to King Charles.
They lead back to?
King Charles. So, you know, the Privy Council is controlled by him, as is GCHQ and the intelligence services.
Yep. Well, no, there's a gap in the sixth report to the Prime Minister directly, five report to the Home Secretary. There are intermediate managers who are supposed to be governed by law. At five, there's a crisis over Northern Ireland. The murders authorised by five in Northern Ireland have now started to surface. So there's a separate crisis there. None of this has been mentioned in the Labour Party manifesto, and no reporting.
Yeah, there's very little. I mean, Martin Summers has been recently talking about this guy, Kevin Fulton, who was apparently involved in the Omar bomb, working for the British as a spy, and various other. In fact, he's got something like 25 indictments against him during the Troubles, and he was even invited by the now King to a memorial service at Westminster Abbey. And so many of the families are pointing to him and saying, you know, why are you honouring this bloke who should be in jail? So there's lots of problems still festering about that.
But here's the thing that makes me pessimistic is nothing in the Labour either manifesto referred to any of these issues. The only one I can bring you up to date on is that Hilary Benn is the new Northern Ireland Secretary and is discussing the issue of repealing the Amnesty Act. The Amnesty Act is the key. This is what protected all the murderers and, you know, made it not possible to have inquests. And, I mean, so that's under discussion, but that's the best I can tell you. I don't know which way it's going to go.
Anyway, look, can we get back to the surveillance business? Because we've just had Google last week, antitrust filing against Google by the federal government, saying that they are effectively using their market dominance to shut everybody else out, rather like, you know, the Rockefellers and Standard Oil did. So this is a potential problem for Google, although they might be just thinking, well, we'll pay a fine, it's just a cost of doing business. They're specifically talking about the advertising and things like that.
Yeah. You were the first person to ever broadcast the fact that Google is a criminal corporation. Those are the words of our parliament. And it was completely ignored. The rule of law in the United Kingdom broke down over this issue and ceased to operate. It's as bad as that. And one of the key, the companies, well, you know who they are, Microsoft, Google, Facebook, were all named in parliamentary evidence. And nothing happened. The last years of the last government will turn out to be the most corrupt since Lord Liverpool ran the government of the United Kingdom in the 18th century from the Jockey Club.
Well, it might be that they're counting on a war, so that will sweep away all these things, Kevin. Many years ago we've been chatting for a long time, but in the last time I spoke to you, you said something pretty extraordinary. was it, I think, every month, £100,000 going from Rupert Murdoch to the Metropolitan Police. Did I get those figures right?
You did indeed. And it's Gordon Brown's application to the Metropolitan Police and the response that is not being reported anywhere. Gordon Brown said, these people disappeared all the evidence and they accused me of committing a crime. And the current Metropolitan Police Commissioner said, right, sir, we will start a new investigation, which is underway. And the police have been told, under oath, that the person who ordered the suppression of the evidence was Rupert Murdoch.
So when was that?
He started in 1987, around the time Daniel Morgan was murdered. Murdoch authorised all sorts of payments. But then the big push started in 2009. In 2009, Murdoch realised that if the police investigation carried on, it would name him. And he brought the managing editor of the News of the World, Stuart Cutner, back from retirement, paid him a rumoured $100,000 a month to weed and fill it, the evidence. And Cutner spent 2 years, 2009 until 2011, I hope I've got those, suppressing and filleting and destroying the evidence. In 2011, Murdoch realised that it wasn't going to work and he closed down the News of the World to cut off all access. And then the second thing that went wrong, the Metropolitan Police stopped investigating. But all that changed on the last day of July this year. A new investigation was started. It's starting with sworn evidence that the person who ordered the suppression of the evidence was Murdoch. And the person who did it was Stuart Cutner.
I know you would probably have been working in Fleet Street round about the time of these famous tapes, the Squidgy Gate and Camilla Gate. You know, this was a massive sensation, the idea that phone conversations between members of the royal family might be broadcast on TV. I mean, it makes phone hacking look fairly tame even, doesn't it? What, can you just tell us about, you know, how... Because it seemed to be, first of all, Diana's voice was leaked, and then it was almost like the divorce playing out on the front page of the Sun. Later, I think it was about six or eight months later, there was a Squidgy Gate, and then there was this Camilla Gate, the tampon gate, some people call it. So what was going on there?
The staff across News International, and that included The Times, The Sunday Times, The Sun, but most of all the News of the World, were just completely off the rails. There was no law operating at Wapping. The staffs of those newspapers either did the hacking themselves or paid for it. And most of this is actually in the public domain. So the question is, why didn't the Metropolitan Police follow through? The Metropolitan Police were told what Murdoch was doing, because the other thing was, it was widely known all across News International what the papers were doing. Everybody knew. You know, you heard people discussed it in the pub. It wasn't a secret. It was only a secret in the national media, who didn't tell anybody what was going on. But then the biggest lump of the national media was The Times, The Sunday Times, The Sun, and The News of the World. So this time everything has changed. There is an investigation. The police have Murdoch's name and Stuart Cutner's name and lots of others. You know that guy in America, Sir William, whatever he's called, Lewis? He was one of the News International executives involved in suppressing the evidence. So they're all in the line now. And the person who has caused it to happen was Gordon Brown. He wrote to the commissioner and said, these people have said I committed a crime and I didn't. They did.
Okay, so just another thing, Kevin. I remember you telling us a while ago you had a piece in the Sunday Times, The Rich Pay No Tax. I mean, I think in a way that was very prophetic or prescient, because now we're in a situation where the tax thresholds are going, they're staying the same, whilst inflation is bringing more and more and more people up into those tax thresholds. Yeah. And so more and more people are having to pay tax, yet the rich and the super rich, they have their money squirreled away off abroad. And as we just heard, King Charles doesn't pay any inheritance tax on the massive estate that he's just inherited. So was that where did you get that headline from? When was it? And, just tell us a bit about that.
October 1990. 20-something of October 1990, I was doing the rich list, and I realized all these people are rich because they don't pay any tax. And the following year, I shifted from the rich list to Insight, you know, the investigative department in the Sunday Times, and I offered this story, and Andrew Neil ignored it. But Andrew Neil's deputy, Tony Bambridge, had no stories that Sunday. And Bambridge ran it. It had nothing to do with Andrew. Andrew Neil would have known that this would affect Murdoch, and he wouldn't have run it, because Murdoch's one of the biggest tax dodgers ever born. And Neil wasn't in, and the paper had no story. And that's how it came about. The deputy editor said, "We have no story," and somebody said, "Well, actually, there is one on the, you know, on the Spike," and they took it off the Spike and ran it. And Murdoch was outraged, because 2 weeks later, I think it was ITV ran a story about Murdoch's tax dodging, and everybody was saying, "Well, you know, the Sunday Times says he's one of them."
Another thing I think is pertinent is I don't know if you noticed that former UN weapons inspector and US Marine Corps intelligence officer Scott Ritter was raided by the FBI last week. They're saying that he's not a journalist, he's a foreign agent. He's still been getting payments from Russia Today. He protests saying, "Well, I've always been a patriot, actually, when I'm criticising US policy in Ukraine. I was doing that before they were paying me, and I'll continue to do it." But this is does sound like, you know, Assange-esque intimidation of Ritter's journalism, which is being quite critical of the US support for the Ukrainians.
Well, you heard it here first. When the problem with Julian Assange reached crisis point about, 8 weeks ago, his QC was told that the United States was in the appeal court on an unlawful basis. And the United States was told the same thing. And lo and behold, 6 weeks later, a deal was done. The pressure, someone in the United Kingdom put the heat on the American embassy, saying, "People know that you're pulling a stunt. You're not in the court with, it's a concept in common law, with clean hands. You're probably surveillancing this court even as the case proceeds." Anyway, some weeks later, the deal was done and Assange was sent home.
But the thing is, as a journalist, as a writer, it's a little bit spooky to have the FBI turn up at your house to say, "We think you're working with the Russians," when actually what you're doing is you're a patriot being just critical of the US foreign policy.
Well, after the system here under the last government, I mean, the Americans set up. I mean, The American government was in the appeal court 8 weeks ago saying this guy has broken the law, da-di-da-di-da, saying the First Amendment doesn't apply to him, and Assange was a journalist, whatever else he was. But they're obviously they're trying to have a go at this guy, but I don't think it'll work. Anybody who takes the case to the American, certainly get it as far as the appeal court, will find that the First Amendment applies. And unless they're actually getting checks from the FSB or somebody, the Russian Secret Service, which this guy wouldn't have been as stupid. But the intriguing thing is nothing has happened here. Not one word has been written about the crisis of mass surveillance, the breakdown of law and order here. And as you know, we as journalists have no protection at all. In law, we don't exist.
Well, that's a little bit worrying. Look, Kevin, you're an ex-army officer. Can you give us your précis of the two big conflicts in the world at the moment? First of all, Ukraine, and secondly, Gaza.
Well, what's that? Years ago, I was in Gaza. I was in Palestine, Israel. And I wrote the first story saying there's about to be an intifada. It was published in the Jordan Times in November 1987. And it said, there's going to be an intifada in hours, not days. And it broke out on the Friday. I'd been told there was going to be an intifada by the British consul, the German ambassador to Amman, and the head of UNRWA, who was an ex-British army like myself. And, I mean, how could you get a story wrong with those kind of sources? And I didn't. And it's a tragedy. But what's happening, as you know, Tony, I learned by law in Sandhurst, the academy. I know what armies can do and can't do because I learned the law in the academy. What's happening in Gaza is mass murder. The word genocide shouldn't be used. The word mass murder should. And in wartime, there's all sorts of things that armies can do to minimize casualties. They can have ceasefires, truces, all sorts of things. The IDF hasn't called a single one of those procedures to try and protect civilians. The IDF have just become another Wehrmacht or SS, mass murderers.
Well, because we just had the anniversary, like literally this week, of the signing of the Geneva Convention in 1948. This is the fundamental basis of international humanitarian law. It talks about the main principles really being to do with protection of civilians and also protection of combatants, both of which the Israelis have violated. I mean, they're doing these torture and raping of Hamas fighters that they find, and they're also killing. I mean, we had at the weekend one of the most horrendous at a prayer meeting in a school, 100+ Palestinian civilians killed by a missile attack. So obviously the Geneva Convention is no more.
The laws of war say that, you know, if your enemy is hiding, you know, and there are civilians around, you've got to call a truce or a ceasefire and get the civilians out of the way. Well, if the IDF, Israeli Defense Forces, they've never once called a ceasefire or a truce. They have just bombed the civilians using huge American conventional bombs. I mean, 2,000 kilo bombs are what you use in a conventional war. You don't use them where there are civilians around.
Yeah, you might use it to blow up a bridge or something, but not a school.
Yeah. Not a tent. You know, they're dropping these bombs on tents. And it's extraordinary the way the international media is reporting the Israeli statements without qualifying them, saying, no, that's not how it works. The law of war says you, if the civilians in the area, you've got to call a ceasefire or a truce and get them out of the way. It's basic. You know, this is how... I know the British Army's had its off days, but generally it hasn't engaged in systematic mass murder, in systematic violation of the rules of war. Not humanitarian law. These are the rules of war.
What about Ukraine? We've just had a big incursion into Russia by the Ukrainians with a lot of NATO kit, mostly NATO kit, actually.
They've launched the attack on Kursk. In July 1943, the outcome of World War II was settled at Kursk. The choosing of Kursk is historically extremely interesting. It's where the Soviet Union effectively won World War II. The war didn't finish for, you know, another year and a half, but the outcome was settled. The Germans lost so badly they couldn't replace either the tanks or the soldiers. And Russia, as Putin is trying to do now, had unlimited manpower. One of the people in the Russian army, a private soldier I knew, told me that as they approached Berlin in Operation Bagration, they captured a German filming unit. And when they were looking at the stuff the Germans had, he said he saw film taken by the Nazis of Russian soldiers without weapons, linking arms and charging the Nazis. And Boris, my friend Boris, said, Kevin, that frightened me. He was a private soldier until the last day of the war. And Kursk was crucial. And it's historically amazing that I think the Ukrainians have called Putin's bluff. You know, Putin's position is complete bluff from beginning to end.
Because Putin himself has said that we know we're not really fighting Ukraine. We're fighting the might of NATO. Their satellites, all their intelligence, their equipment, their cash, everything is NATO, really.
Well, somebody, a Russian friend, within the last few days, said that there's a total clampdown on good information in Russia. He said, but the majority of Russian people know this is a stunt and a con, but there's nothing they can do about it. You know, you raise your voice, you find yourself doing 15 years in the gulag. It's a bluff. Putin's, you know, there was a strategic mistake. When the Soviet Union fell, we, the West, told the Russians that we wouldn't move NATO to the border, and we did. And that was a mistake. Nobody calculated on a psychopath like Putin turning up.
Well, hang on, because, I mean, the Russians, not just Putin, the Russians see it as a provocation, Kevin, not a mistake. That was a lie.
Well, no, it's a special military action. Come on.
No, I mean the West moving up to the Russian border, even though they promised they would never do that.
We did promise we'd never do that, yes. So we broke the promise, and we were stupid. Mm. This was a strategic error of catastrophic dimensions. And then you get somebody like Putin in Russia.
So how's the Ukraine conflict going to go, do you think?
If the Ukraine are able to... Well, they've called an emergency in Belgorod, the next oblast to Kursk. If the Ukrainians can sustain... some kind of fighting in Kursk and Belgorod, Putin's position will collapse. His losses in... There are graves. the Russian invasion of Afghanistan came to an end when the Russian mothers objected to the body bags. Well, the Russian mothers can't do anything now because nobody knows how many body bags there are. And it's suppressed information. But if Putin has to roll in significant forces, then his whole position is undermined. But this is something that should never have happened.
Okay, Kevin, that'll do.
Yep.
Kevin Carhill, thanks very much for joining us.
Okay, Tony, cheers.